You're listening to Talking Taiwan with your host, Felicia Lin.
March is Women's History Month, and so we thought this would be the perfect time to release the first episode of the Trailblazing Taiwanese Women series sponsored by NATWA, the North America Taiwanese Women's Association. Last September, I had the pleasure of interviewing actor, writer, and director Michelle Krusek. Her IMDb page displays an impressive list of acting roles dating back to 1992. We talked about the different phases of her career, starting with her one-woman show, Made in Taiwan, which earned her much critical acclaim. She wrote, directed, and acted in it in her 20s. Then there was her first main character role in a feature film, Saving Face, a film that put her on my radar and so many others in 2004. In 2020, she portrayed the legendary Anna May Wong in the Netflix series Hollywood. Stepping into that role helped her to rethink the institutionalized racism that she's experienced as an actor.
Michelle also talked about her directorial projects.
Michelle also expressed her thoughts on the SAG-AFTRA strike and so much more.
This episode of Talking Taiwan has been sponsored by NATWA, the North America Taiwanese Women's Association. NATWA was founded in 1988, and its mission is 1. To evoke a sense of self-esteem and enhance women's dignity. 2. To oppose gender discrimination and promote gender equality. 3. To fully develop women's potential and encourage their participation in public affairs. 4. To contribute to the advancement of human rights and democratic development in Taiwan. 5. To reach out and work with women's organizations worldwide to promote peace for all. To learn more about NATWA, visit their website, www.natwa.com. Without further ado, here's our interview.
Welcome to the podcast, Michelle.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
It's so wonderful to have you here. Most people know you as an actor, and now you're transitioning into being a director. And I wanted to start with, how did you actually even get on this path of being an actor? I understand you probably wanted to be some kind of artist, but like, why acting? Like, how did you know that was the path that you wanted to take?
Well, I originally wanted to be a dancer, and my mother, my Taiwanese mother, of course, put that thought out of my head as soon as I announced it to the world. And I think I always knew I wanted to be physical. And because dancing was physical and acting is another form of using your body, that was sort of the natural segue. I, you know, found out about a magnet school that was in my area that had the disciplines of performance, and acting was one of them. So I auditioned and was able to get into the magnet school. And I think that formally launched my education. And the desire was always there to perform. And I think that really came from a need to be seen. I think as a kid, it was just something I really desired, you know, so acting allowed me to have that platform.
Now, does the desire to be seen, does that have anything to do with being Asian or that sort of thing? Because I don't really know what the makeup of your neighborhood was like.
Yeah, that's a great question. I grew up in a predominantly white community. There were Filipinos in the area. I grew up in Virginia Beach. And I never felt I was cool enough to be Filipino. So they were all very, it felt like there was a lot of them. Whereas with, you know, being Taiwanese, I felt like I only saw a handful of, there was like a Chinese kid, a Chinese friend who was my friend, a Japanese kid, you know, maybe an Indian kid. And just that handful of us were all struggling to find who our community was. But I think at that time, the need to be seen maybe came from the fact that my parents were both working and not a lot of attention was put upon me. And it came from not just the desire to have some visibility as an Asian kid. I think I was very aware of that. But I think it was also acting gave me a place to be felt, to be heard, and to be experienced. And I don't know if I even knew how to do that in my own personal life, but acting was a platform that gave me those tools.
You've had such a long career. I read your op-ed and how you've definitely had some stereotypically Asian character roles that you're offered. Like, how did you deal with that? And were there some that you accepted and why?
I think my first 10 years in the industry was probably because I was Asian and people were looking to fill that role. It was a kind of tokenism that we all accepted. And until people started to acknowledge that we were tired of being, you know, second and third tertiary characters and that we weren't always in service, that we didn't want to always be in service of the protagonist as a tool, as a laborer in their story, I was getting hired predominantly to do that. Maybe sometimes producers or writers weren't consciously doing that, but as we know now, racial bias is so unconscious. And at the beginning of my career, I happily took on those roles because I could prove myself. I could learn the craft and I could hone those parts to find my strengths and work on my weaknesses. But eventually, after putting in all your time and thousands of hours of work, I could see that there was a ceiling that I just couldn't break through, whether it was by luck, which is what a lot of people tell you, you know, acting is luck. But in my case, I was definitely getting opportunities and often feeling that I fell short because I just somehow wasn't good enough. And once I started playing the role of Anna Mae Wong and I looked into her history, I saw the same systems in place. And I really woke up and realized that I was holding myself accountable in a way that wasn't really acknowledging just the institutional racism I was up against and the challenges and blocks of being a person of color and a woman.
So when you say holding yourself accountable, meaning like you felt that this was your burden to shoulder, that you had to do something about being represented properly or something like that?
I mean, I think the burden is that when you have a success and failure model, which is basically you get the job or you don't get the job, you spend a lot of time trying to figure out why you didn't get the job. And I mean, now I'm a director, so I can tell an actor, you didn't get a job and it was not in your control. I can say that confidently. But as a young actress coming up, especially as an Asian woman who grew up in a culture where you had to prove yourself and you had to be good enough, and no one kind of said to me, listen, you just may not be good enough for the situation and that has nothing to do with you. I grew up in a model where I had to prove myself. I had to do a good job. And if I didn't do a good job, I had to figure out why I didn't do a good job and I had to fix it. Mm-hmm. And that just isn't the way artists and the journey of an artist works. But when you're young and up and coming in terms of your development, you don't really understand it. It takes a lot of maturity to really master that concept and trust in yourself. And that wasn't something I had growing up. And even though I was getting work, I don't know if I was really being trusted with meaty parts. And I don't know if I was learning that the burden was not on me, that it was on the industry, and only time and education was going to change that.
Well, that's pretty amazing for me to hear you say it after having such a long career. It wasn't until the role of Anna Mae Wong came around that you had a lot of these realizations. But I'm also wondering, having such a long career, what is it that you think has helped you to accomplish what you have so far? Like, what helped you to keep going?
I think my natural survival instinct of trying to figure things out, and having grown up in an immigrant home where my mother had to figure it out, and I come from a working class family, and there's a lot of pride in pulling yourself up by the bootstraps.
Figuring it out.
Yeah. And that is a very big part of my identity. I'm not somebody who naturally feels entitled. You know, I always feel like if I earned it, then I will get that opportunity. So I think just that instinct to keep moving forward and to not not get set back, which is something that I think is a natural work ethic that was either instilled in me or maybe I was born with it. But I think it's just a natural part of my spirit. So staying in the game, so to speak, or staying in my journey as an artist hasn't been difficult.
I can definitely see the theme here because you said that you started off wanting to be seen, and I can see how this is a thread that goes through. And then speaking about parts, one of your earliest parts we have to talk about is Saving Face, of course. In Saving Face, Michelle's character, Wilhelmina, or Will, is a lesbian surgeon who is closeted to her mother. Meanwhile, Will's widowed mother has gotten pregnant and refuses to name who the father is. Can you talk to me about what it meant for you to get that role? Because I understand that was one of your first roles where you were the main character.
Right? Yeah, that was my first leading role in a feature film. And I don't know what it was in me that, you know, since I was a child, I could see that I watched a lot of television because I didn't have the parents that sent me to camps. I spent a lot of time reading and watching TV. And it's very apparent that Asian people weren't on television. And I think there was this part of me that thought, well, I'm going to change that. I'm going to really change that. And that dream was very alive in me and still continues to be to this day. So when Saving Face came along, it was really an opportunity where I felt that I needed to represent. And it was very rare to have a leading role being offered to you, especially one that was so well written and directed by another Asian woman of color. And Alice Wu was a unicorn at that time. She was gay, Asian, a woman, an excellent writer, and an incredible director. So that was just an opportunity that felt like it was like a godsend or a miracle. And I thought this was the sign that things were going to change and that I had worked really hard to finally earn that part. And I think I did, but I just assumed, wrongly so, that it just would get easier from there. And that wasn't the case. So I think the role in and of itself was an incredible opportunity to fill my fantasy of representing. But I think the hard part, the surprising part, was that I thought it was going to be a floodgate after that, and it wasn't.
How could you not? I think perhaps the film was kind of ahead of its time. I'm also curious, I did see an interview where you talked about what it meant for you. I think it was an interview with you and your co-star, Lynn, and you were talking about it. And I wonder if you could share a little bit how you prepared for it, because you had to, you know, about Mandarin and things like that, right, to get the role?
Yeah, the Mandarin was so hard. I went to Taiwan, I think now I'm kind of forgetting, but I know I went at least two times and I did an immersion program. And Alice is fluent in Mandarin and I was not. And I grew up kind of speaking it, but discovering that I really wasn't speaking it properly at all. And when they were considering me and I knew that Alice was concerned about my Mandarin, I flew myself to Taiwan and spent several, maybe like 3 or 4 weeks the first time. And then when I got the part, I went back and spent another month there just trying to develop the tongue, the tones. You know, it's such a hard language to learn as an adult. But luckily, I have an ear for it. And Alice kind of relaxed her standards. I think she wanted someone who could speak it without any accent. But I have an ABC accent when I speak it. And I think she was willing to accept that for the part. Yeah.
Well, that's incredible, the dedication before you even got the role, going back there to work on the language. And I understand that you also did a lot of preparation when you were up for the role for Anime Wong as well, right?
Yeah, you know, that part was on the page. It didn't seem like a really big part. The scenes themselves were well written. But in terms of like her through line through the series, I really didn't know just how meaty the part was. But I work with a mentor, a coach, and she kind of made me realize that I was not looking at this part in the way that it deserved. I think because initially I was seeing this as a tragic character. And that's how I saw her. But once I started getting into the history, and you know, the fun part of acting is the history, the fact that you don't have to make up a lot of stuff. And research, it's one of my favorite things to do, especially when a part is autobiographical or historical, I mean.
Yeah.
And that part is so fun and juicy. And I was listening to her talk and there's so much out there about her. And I just didn't realize it until I started getting into the role. But yeah, that was the easy part. I think the hard part was really convincing myself that I could step into such a iconic role. And I think really the makeup artists and the designers did that part for me. Because when I look at pictures, I'm like, wow, I really do look like her in some of those shots. And that was remarkable. And I think that is the skill of everybody coming together.
And now you're taking on the role of being a director more so. And can you talk a little bit about that and some of your recent projects? And are you more so shifting away from acting into being a director?
I don't know if I'm shifting away from acting. I feel like I've hit a point in my career where I'm not hustling in the same way I used to hustle in my, you know, early part. Mm-hmm. I think parts come to me that are meant to come to me. And I'm being a little more discerning now in recognizing whether or not, like, I get a lot of offers or parts to play Asian moms. And, you know, I'm inherently American because I've grown up in America. And now when I see myself putting on an accent, if I don't feel I can believe myself in the part, I don't want to try and do it. Because there's enough actors out there that have that contextual history. Whereas, you know, 10 years ago, I would have said, yeah, I can play anything. But now I'm much more, I don't know, I guess my authenticity meter is much sharper. So I'm not saying yes to everything and I'm not looking at work begets work, which is kind of what I used to do, you know. But what has really transitioned for me is that my desire as an actor was to always make meaningful work and to have that representation there. And as a writer and as a director, I feel I can put in that valuable work through the story. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm concentrating on. If a part comes to me that feels that it has that kind of weight and substance, great. But if it comes to me through writing and directing and through story, then I'm interested in supporting that.
Yeah, and that reminded me, I wanted to talk to you about Made in Taiwan, which is your solo show, which is probably one of your most visible works where you're actually in something that you actually directed. Can you talk about that and where that idea came from and what doors that opened for you?
Yeah, that was such a fun time, such a wonderful experience for me to write something. I was, you know, only 20 years old and I wrote something.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that really resonated. And I think what worked about that show was that it was both funny and somewhat sad. It was funny and sad. It seems not complex, but you know, that's hard to do. And it was quite moving to tell the story of my relationship to my mother. And this is my adoptive mother. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's such a extraordinary character and so complex. And I understood her more than I understood myself growing up. Mm-hmm. And through her, I was able to learn as an actor because she was like the ultimate figure. And because I understood her so thoroughly, I could write about her. I could embody her. I could talk about the themes that forced her to be the way she was as my mother. And I loved her, but I was also very compressed by her as a daughter.
Yeah.
And that theme of not being good enough within Chinese culture. I think it's a very universal theme, not just within our culture, but within many cultures. Mm-hmm. And I think I was able to tap into a very universal idea of mm-hmm. how our parents can both love us and also stop us. And so that was a coming of age story that I think was very successful. And as a result of that, it really launched my career in Los Angeles. I was able to get a deal with ABC as an actor, and I was able to present the show in many different forms to various showrunners. And at the time, I was a little bit too young to really understand how the industry worked. And I kind of fumbled the ball on that a few times. But looking back, I realized that had the climate been that you could be an actor, writer, and director, which is what you can do now, I would have probably taken a different path. I would have continued originating material. But instead, I stuck primarily as being an actor. And now, in my maturity, I'm turning back to writing and directing.
It opened up the doors for a deal with ABC. He wrote about that in your op-ed as well. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that time, because it sounds like that was kind of a challenging time, the ups and downs of having that deal and what that meant, the kind of roles you were offered.
Well, I think the biggest thing I can see in hindsight is that I wrote the story and it did what it was supposed to do, which was it gave me visibility. But once I was being put in a leadership position to transmute that material into something beyond a stage show, like a television show or a feature film, I don't think I really had the skill set at the time to really make that happen. Not on my own and not with the team I had in place, I think. Maybe if I had a more skilled showrunner who would have taken me under his or her wing, I would have needed that guidance. But at the same time, I was also kind of told point blank by a network head who said, your material is so progressive and I don't think the audiences are quite ready for your material. Ooh. It's so raw and it's so honest and it's so dark. This is really great, but I don't know if audiences are quite ready for you. And I really think he was probably pretty accurate. You know, Margaret Cho had amazing material and they really tried to stuff her into a box. And the backlash on the failure of that show was so strong that I think it permeated, you know, for a very long time.
Michelle is referring to Margaret Cho's ABC sitcom, All American Girl, which aired in 1994 and only lasted one season. It wouldn't be until another 20 years that there'd be another sitcom featuring an Asian American family.
That's why we could only count on one hand how many Asian films we had. And just the inherent racism, which, you know, the anti-Asian hate that's so prevalent today, it didn't just come out of nowhere. It's always been there.
Right.
There's just something to attach to it, which was at the time the pandemic, the virus. But prior to that, it was just an unconscious thing, which is you look different from me and I don't see myself experiencing your emotions because you're not me. And I think that was just something that was very prevalent, which is a white person's never going to see themselves in the shoes of a person of color, especially an Asian person. I always kind of fall into the sociological themes in play. But I think it was a real thing. And maybe this is the part of my brain that's like, well, maybe if I had just been clever enough, I could have made it happen. But if there was anything, I was very clever in my 20s. But the thing that I think I lacked was a real deep understanding of my own material and my own sense of being a leader. That was not something I was skilled enough to do. And that's because I was raised in a pretty oppressive household where I was a rule follower and I could go get them, but I was always going to play by the rules. And if someone said, these are your rules when you're not going to be a rule breaker, I would just be like, oh, okay. Well, let me figure out what sandbox I'm supposed to be in and I'll stay in there. And then, you know, you get older and you're in your 30s and you find yourself sobbing, going, what was I doing in my 20s?
Well, but you can't go back. I mean, sometimes it's just somebody saying that to you and then it permeates you and goes into your consciousness or something. And also, like you said, you were 20-something. You didn't have the life experience. You weren't equipped or you didn't know yourself, not just your material, but yourself also.
Yeah. Well, I think also this is kind of where being a good Asian kid can go against you, which is empowering ourselves as a community to see ourselves as leaders and to be our own leaders now, which is, I think, something this generation won't have a problem with. But in my generation, you kind of kept your head low and you did what you were told. And if you worked really hard, you would get rewarded. And that's kind of what I thought was going to get me that kind of progressive movement forward. And, you know, I was always working, but in that op-ed piece, as I said, the more I worked, the more invisible I felt. And it's because maybe I didn't have a strong alignment with who I really was internally. I was following a kind of goal and success that I had envisioned.
That was not yours.
Well, I had always envisioned that kind of success and I was being given that opportunity. But I don't know if I was lined up with the kind of material I was trying to do, wanting to do. No one was handing it to me. And I had to make it. But now I realize it doesn't matter. You still have to make it no matter who you are. It doesn't matter if you're the most successful white dude in the industry. You still have to make your own material. And that's the big secret, you know.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of making your own material, I think it's really interesting how Made in Taiwan has kind of like come full circle, because I read on one of your websites that your short film Bite was kind of related to Made in Taiwan, right? In Michelle's director statement about her 2022 short film Bite, she states, "When I wrote Made in Taiwan in 2001, my perspective was that of a young woman looking up to my mother. Now, many moons later, I revisit this material, but from the perspective of the mother."
Yeah, as a writer, because of my point of origin, being an adoptee and a fortune teller, predicted my future, and my own birth mother was also adopted, and the fortune teller impacted her adoption. I see the world in myth and spirituality.
Now I'm curious, did the fortune teller predict that you would be someone that was in a public eye or a performer or something like to that effect?
I think he predicted that I would travel the world and that I would not stay in Taiwan. I would go to America and that I would have success in America.
And now for a short break. Talking Taiwan is the longest running Taiwan related podcast and a Golden Crane Award winner. And our 2-person team is committed to continuing to producing meaningful content for you. As an independently produced podcast, we want to take a moment to thank all of our listeners and donors for your support. You make our work possible. Talking Taiwan has been around for 10 years already, and with your support, we'll be around for 10 more. We have a lot of exciting things in the works that we will be announcing soon. To support our work, you can make a contribution to our GoFundMe campaign, or at talkingtaiwan.com/support. Contributions can be made to talkingtaiwanpodcast@gmail.com via PayPal or Zelle. Now, back to our episode.
You were asking.
We were talking about, I mean, Taiwan and how that is related to your short film Bite.
Yes, yes. So the reason why I am writing from the point of view of a personal narrative is because there are such rich stories embedded in ourselves. And because I kind of came from this unusual folkloric origin that was told to me, whether it was true or not, I mean, I have to believe that it is true, because my birth mother insists on that is why she gave me up for adoption. But as a result, I feel like I have a lot of rich personal narratives to draw from. And because it was a long time goal of mine to adapt my material into something else, I keep going back to it. I think there's an archetype in the mother figure, and it's something I'm very interested in exploring. So I took it as an opportunity. I always try to write something that I know first, and then gradually, especially now that I'm working a genre, you can find ways to take the narrative and disguise it. And genre gives you, especially in horror, it gives you great visuals. And so even though it's a personal story, I can disguise the material with some really incredible visuals, because that's the genre I'm working in.
It seems like you have quite an interest in horror, because I did take a look at your short film Nian as well, which is pretty appropriate for the season. Nian is a Chinese character which means year, and it's also the name of the mythological creature that emerges around the time of the Lunar New Year. In Michelle's short film by the same name, the main character stands up to a racist bully with the help of Nian. Can you talk a little bit about Nian?
Yeah. In the end was a bit of a surprise. I was tapped to pitch 5 or 6 ideas to 20th Digital Studio. And they kind of showed me a bunch of their anthology of horror shorts. And once I watched a few of them, I mean, Get Out is one of my favorite films, but I never really thought I would be working in that genre. But once I started pitching my ideas and then started working in this genre, I saw the beauty in this material. I mean, like I said earlier, you can have amazing visuals to tell a psychological story. And I'm very invested in understanding depth psychology. I love that kind of material. I study Jungian dreams, so I love Jungian archetypes. And the genre lends itself to fantastic visuals and stories with high extreme consequences. I love tension. I love a visceral ride when I'm watching a film. And working in genre, especially with horror, thriller, and then psychology, all of that kind of plays to my sweet spot. I've been a chronic anxiety-ridden person my whole life, so I understand. I deeply understand tension.
Right. And since you were talking about motherhood, I'm wondering, can you talk about how being a mother yourself has shaped your perspective on parenting and your heritage and ethnicity?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind about parenting is everything is life and death for the first 5 or 6 years. Everything is, they're going to die, you know, they're going to starve, they're going to get hit by a car. After I gave birth, my son had an infection in his eye, you know, and it was just from the very beginning, it feels like you are on this roller coaster of trying to keep your children alive.
Well, and they're so dependent on you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They're dependent. And then, of course, you pathologize everything, right? Like if they lie to you,
especially with the firstborn, I'm sure.
Right. Right. If they lie to you one time, they're going to be liars the rest of their lives, you know? If they stole candy, they're going to be thieves. There's that constant seesaw of reactions. So for me, it's also funny and it's a great place to pull stories from. Mm-hmm. My husband and I are constantly fighting about co-parenting, and I think parenting is one of the great gifts and also just such a treasure trove for stories. I wrote a series about sexual intimacy when you first have kids and just the decline of that and how it affects your relationship. Anyway, parenting has really been kind of a wonderful, eye-opening experience for me in so many different ways. So I think I can draw from parenting for a very long time. And because the stakes are so high, you can really have fun with it.
Right. Can you talk about where you're going with your directing?
Yeah. So with directing, I'm writing a very personal narrative that is about passing of my father, and how he died was very sudden. And the film is about a woman whose father's sudden death sends her back in time to high school. And it's kind of like a quantum leap where she travels back and she thinks that she's there to solve her parents' marriage so that he doesn't die in the future the way he does die. But instead, it's really a personal reckoning of her own personal transformation with herself and her mother. And once again, the mother theme comes up, and it's because it's unresolved, Felicia.
Yeah.
And a big part of my desire to write that film is to revisit the coming of age story from the vantage point of someone now in their 40s. I don't think we write enough stories for women in their 40s. I feel like in my 40s, I'm so much wiser, and I understand things, and I'm way more interesting as a person than in my 20s and 30s. And I feel like we need to write more stories from this midlife. So that's the film I'm writing. And then Nana's being made into a feature. Once the strikes are over, I'll return into that process. So, yeah, I have 2 features that I'm working on, and I have an Anna May Wong idea. It's a pilot idea that I've been writing, because she deserves her own many, many seasons of a TV show. But I have a very particular take on her, having played her, so I have an idea that I've been fleshing out for a while now. So, yeah, in terms of the cabinet being full, or the well being full, I should say, the cabinet. I'm always thinking of food metaphors. But the well feels like there's a lot there at the moment.
Yeah. That's amazing. And since you mentioned the strikes, could you talk a little bit about that and your take on that and Asian representation in Hollywood?
Yeah, it's very clear for me, having gone through this cycle of the strike, that actors, we subsist on residuals. We have historically done maybe 3 or 4 jobs a year, and on network television, they will pay you for the amount of times your show airs and repeats itself. And you can live off of that money for an entire year. And, you know, and it's probably equal to maybe a teacher's salary. Mm. And now with streamers and these networks that are telling us that there are no residuals to be had, well, obviously they're paying advertisers. Mm. They're tracking this. There is a way to track it, but, you know, in the original proposal when we were agreed that we would not be getting residuals for streaming shows, we didn't know what the technology was. And now we know that they can track this stuff. And the fact that they're airing and there's so many subscriptions where you can watch and rewatch shows and we're only paid this very measly sum at the very beginning and nothing else, it is very hard to sustain a middle-class living off of that. For me, that has been a significant downgrade in pay, so much so that I'm almost embarrassed to say how much I've gotten paid for things. And the AI is another kind of new technology where they're saying, we don't know how it's going to work. Mm-hmm. Everything's free right now. But that's what they said about streaming, where they approach something that's a new technology and we have the disadvantage of not knowing what it is. And as artists, we are made to feel that we have, that we're lucky to just have a job. And contractually, we always suffer. And we end up cobbling our careers together through lots of different types of work. And not all of it is meaningful. And at a certain point in your career, you do have to ask for fair wages. And since executive pay is so overly compensated, there's enough wealth to distribute. And I think in this country that we are having, I think there might be like 300,000 laborers who are currently on strike. Mm. Maybe 320, 350,000 was a number that I had seen. And there are strikes happening all over this country because I think the wage disparity between working class and the corporate executives, it's so severe that I think it's time that people who are doing the work are paid fair, reasonable wages. We are the ones responsible for giving these corporate executives the cush job. All they have to do is sit in the profit. And I think it's gross, it's disturbing, and I think it's a reflection of our culture that we do not value labor in this country.
Unfortunately, this happens across different industries, the whole disparity between people in the C-suite. And I understand you also supported the bill to support funding for nonprofit theaters in California. Is that right?
Yes, I was part of it's the Senator Bill SB 805.
Yes.
And that bill, it basically, it gives everybody a wage for anybody who works in the theater. But what happens with nonprofit theaters is that they can't afford to pay all the fees that it takes to employ everyone. That's something that a lot of companies can afford to do. But theaters, nonprofit theaters, don't make enough money to make that sustainable. And so that bill gave nonprofit theaters funding to help pay their workers the hourly wage that is now standard in California. Yeah. You can't work for free in California. You can't volunteer. And so that bill was passed, and I think Governor Newsom had to allocate the funds, and I believe that's kind of where the bill stopped, and then I think another bill took over for that.
That's a tremendous accomplishment. It's unfortunate that I think California is the only state where this has happened, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a double-edged sword, which is, it's great that nonprofit, anybody who is working in theater gets a living wage of, I think our standard is $15, I think, which is, I think, the highest in the country. Mm-hmm. So it's great, or it might be a little higher than that now, but it's great that is happening. But for nonprofit theaters that can't afford to pay, I think it's called the master pay. I'm totally blanking on this, mm-hmm. but because they can't afford to employ that middle person that pays all the wages, it just means that a lot of nonprofit theaters would have to close. So there is funding that is being allocated to help them stay open. And a lot of these theaters are, they're at the root of these communities that don't have the arts. Mm-hmm. And growing up, the arts was how I was able to create an identity for myself. It's where I found my career. And a lot of these lower income neighborhoods, mm-hmm. when you don't have an artistic center, or you don't have a neighborhood feel, then there is no ability to help that, to create that outreach for those young kids so that they have a community to go to and find a place to develop themselves, which is how I developed as an actor.
Having gone through all the things you have, is there a particular experience that you think humbled you, or that you learned from, something that maybe it was like some kind of a suffering, or like that gave you some kind of awakening?
When I was younger, or just in any walk of, in
oh,
any chapter
yeah,
of my
I guess
life.
Whatever stands out to you, like maybe overall, like a major thing.
Boy, I feel like life.
Too many. There's too many to name.
I mean, life okay. is just a daily onslaught, you know? I mean, interesting. I mean, I think that for me, it's spiritual phases in life. Mm-hmm. And during the pandemic, I felt so much rage at the anti-Asian hate mm. that was being directed at our community. Mm. And it was very painful mm. to see how our community was being treated. Mm-hmm. And I think that having access to that rage mm-hmm. and seeing the Black community go through that rage in such a powerful way, it allowed me to access my own anger mm-hmm. because I was watching another community go through it. Mm-hmm. And I felt very aligned with that movement, with BLM. Mm-hmm. And when I would see, I think John Boyega is an actor, and I watched a speech, and I actually used to have his speech on my Instagram, and I just recently took it down. But in his speech, he's talking about his Blackness and talking about being denied his Blackness. And I think for most of my life, I was trying so hard to be white mainstream culture for so long that I was trying to hide my Chineseness. And when I would find myself struggling to articulate that, and the shame that I felt saying those words about trying to hide my Chineseness, I always felt very ungrounded. But during the pandemic, watching the BLM movement really gave me a sense of entitlement that I could feel my anger. Mm-hmm. And because there was so much hatred being volleyed at the elderly and senior citizens and just mm-hmm. regular Asian people walking on the street. It was so in our faces.
Yeah.
And nobody cared. Nobody was interested in it. Nobody wanted to even fight for it. It existed in these ways where we would have to point out to people, like, do you see what's happening? Mm-hmm. And that in and of itself made me really wake up and realize that we have to fight for ourselves. Mm-hmm. We have to confront the shame that we carry about how much we've assimilated ourselves in a way that disowned our connection to our Chineseness, and being proud of that. Even though I was always taught to be proud, it was still coming from fear. And I think that's the relationship I'm now rearranging in my life, that the perception of who I am is no longer coming from the outside external world, but is coming from my own development of how I see myself and how I wish to develop that identity. And I think that transformation is what's compelling me now as a writer, director, and as an actor to really hunt those stories down and really flesh out that transformation. Because I think it is happening that we are becoming more empowered as a community. But in order to make it land, in order for us to witness that change, I think we have to be able to make it very visible to each other, to ourselves first and then to each other. And that's really where I'm at.
Well, what did you mean when you say it was coming from fear?
Well, I think that my mother was very much that you have to own who you are. You have to be proud of being Chinese, but it was in defiance because she was so terrified of being cut down, being made into a small person, mm-hmm. being told that her accent.
So was it's defensive.
It's a defense mechanism. It's a kind of armoring because of all of the antagonism and the aggression that she felt as a woman of color who migrated here very late in life, that her accent was reflective of her education, of her intellect, of her abilities. And I think that it was being put on as an armor to say, I'm not going to let you take me down. And that in and of itself, there is strength in that, but I don't know how empowered it is in a way that feels healthy.
Right.
And that's what I'm reworking. And getting into that anger and rage during the pandemic was kind of the first step to accepting that, that I'm really pissed off, you know? Whereas before, you always had to kind of just be like, we are handicapped and we have a lot of obstacles, but you know, I have to work harder and I have to really prove myself and I have to be more American or I have to do this and I have to do that. And all of those things are personal costs to our own empowerment. Mm-hmm. And finding out that I was very angry about it and seeing another community fight that civil rights battle was very awakening for me.
Yeah, for sure. Watching them really made me reflect on being Asian and what was our voice and what's our community? How do we need to stand up for ourselves? It's an interesting evolution. It makes me think, like, what is it, the different steps? Like, he goes through the sadness, the grief, and then the anger, and then the whatever.
Yeah. Hopefully there's a different step. There's the denial.
After anger, right?
That's right. That's right. There's numbness. Yeah. There's, I think so. You know, that's why I was saying life does a number on you because it's so slow to go through each step. And you think you've made strides, and we have. We have made a lot of strides. But, you know, are we there yet? No, we're not there yet.
Well, could you actually share some advice or some words of wisdom to younger people who are perhaps thinking of taking a similar path to you, whether it's going into acting or directing?
Well, you know, youth is always lost on the youth, right? I think the best advice I have goes back to trying to see if you can get inside who you think you are, who you're trying to be, who you're supposed to be, and going back to a place where you can reorient yourself to a state of truth, a level of knowingness that comes from your own being and not from an external force, not from external influences. And that's very, very hard because we are such a culture of influence. And if you can find the time to be with yourself in authentic ways that allow you some insight and reconnection to yourself with a capital S, I think those moments will hopefully give you a sustainability where you can take on life and you can pursue the things you want, but you can do it with without losing who you are in the process.
Right. And I just have two questions. One is, since this is a Talking Taiwan podcast, if you could talk about your connection to Taiwan, and then I leave it open to you if there's anything else you wanted to share that we haven't talked about.
Well, I just came back from Taiwan. I went this past Christmas and New Year's, and I went with four other families, five of us. My son goes to a Chinese immersion program. Mm-hmm. And the whole ABC parenting is to teach your kids Chinese and you try and get them to go to a place where they speak Chinese and you're like, okay, now speak Chinese.
go.
Yeah, go. But I love Taiwan so much. My family is all there. And it was the first time that I explored Taiwan outside of Taipei because my family's in Taipei.
Right.
And Formosa is the beautiful island. And it's the first time I went to Taroko Gorge and Hualien and I did the whole tour. And it was so beautiful and stunning. And I had a lot of pride seeing that part of the island because I normally just go and I see Taipei, which is beautiful, but I go for the food and the night markets. But this part of Taiwan that I was able to see was more of the natural beauty of Taiwan.
Yes.
And it was wonderful to see and experience that part of Taiwan's beauty. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my son bartered in Chinese, and I was very proud. He was able to, what is it? Sa jia.
How old is your son?
He is 9. So,
oh, wow, already doing that. That's
well, I think he kind of did it as a fun thing, and the vendor kind of went with it.
Played along,
which was really sweet. Very, very sweet. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. And anything you wanted to share that we haven't talked about?
Anything I'd like to share? Oh, I thought you were very thorough in your questions. So.
Well, thank you so much for your openness and sharing. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. I think if there's anything I try and do in my work now is to be as honest and transparent as possible. I feel like that's always been maybe one of my greatest strengths as a writer. And when I've veered from that, when I've done something different or I've done the thing I think I'm supposed to do, I realize that I'm just not as successful being true to myself. But when I am really truthful in that process, I find that it just becomes more clear that that works for me, is to just be honest.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule.
Yeah, no, thank you.
I've been speaking with actor, writer, and director Michelle Krusek. This episode is a part of the Trailblazing Taiwanese Women series, sponsored by NATWA, the North America Taiwanese Women's Association. To learn more about NATWA, visit their website at www.natwa.com.
Now it's time for you to show us some love. Rate us on Spotify, or if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Audible, leave us a review there. It helps others to discover Talking Taiwan. To learn more about any of the items mentioned in this episode, visit our website, talkingtaiwan.com. There we'll list any related links. Thank you for listening to another episode of Talking Taiwan. I'm your host, Felicia Lin.
Talking Taiwan is brought to you by Forumosa.com.